Welcome back to Bibliosinensis.
Hello, Hauntiers. Happy autumn.
Happy autumn indeed. So, what do we got this time?
So, today we are actually drinking the infamous sweater weather.
At last.
It is finally chilly here in Los Angeles.
Yes.
I think I actually wore my hair down after how many months and did not break a sweat. Surprise, surprise. But sweater weather is the first seasonal tee I ever designed for Tea Spectral. And it's actually a pumpkin spice tea.
Ah.
Which, you know, it's the weather for it.
Yeah.
But it is not your basic pumpkin chai.
Oh my god.
No, it's actually inspired off of baked goods and all the goodies that you smell when you walk by a bakery in autumn.
That's interesting.
Yeah, and it has a few extra spices that aren't the typical pumpkin spice. Like, it does have some orange peel in it.
Yes.
And the orange peel actually gives it a marmalade taste because it's paired with vanilla bean.
Delish.
Yeah.
If you guys haven't had this yet, it is very addicting.
Yes. I can safely say it's probably our most addicting tea, as our customers have told us.
Yeah.
Interesting fact, though. We are actually drinking... Cheers.
Cheers.
We're actually drinking the second brew of this loose leaf. Give it a taste. Let me know what you think of it.
It's a little stronger, that's for sure.
Stronger? Okay.
I mean, what is it supposed to taste like?
Well, I think it's interesting because it actually brings out more of the vanilla bean on the second note.
Okay.
And that goes for any of our teas. We use actual vanilla bean pods in our tea. So you get the essential oils and the oils in general first, on first flush the most. But by the second brew, you actually get, like, the open pods. So another thing that opens up on the second flush is the star anise. So you get that licorice undertone.
Okay.
Yeah, so you get more of a vanilla licorice root undertone on the second flush. Random trivia for all of you that listen to the podcast.
It's nice.
So, carrying on with the subject of writers
for
season two, you're actually interviewing me for a change, or hosting.
Due to the fact that Steph's actually more of a novel writer than a poetry writer, unlike me or Luke, we are basically getting into nitty gritty of the NaNoWriMo.
Yes.
National
Novel Writing Month is upon us.
Yes.
I just got an email from them telling everyone that it is the time to declare that you are writing a novel.
Huzzah.
So, I can't agree more. I know I'm on the fence about it. I don't know if I'm going to do it this season. Usually, Tea Spectral's pretty busy around this time of year.
Yeah. I know that prepping for it's always, It's an exercise in itself. It's like getting your head together, just you know, getting in the game.
Mm-hmm.
Due to that, I actually found an article just for getting ready for NaNoWriMo.
Mm-hmm.
The fun part about this is, unlike the other articles, which are from like 2014 or older, this is actually written. It's still written. And it's from somebody that is an avid NaNoWriMo participant, Steve Shepard. He's a Storyist developer.
Interesting.
And a majority of NaNoWriMo reviewers or I guess basically documentists, they're all in video now. You know, they're recording themselves, like, hanging out with people and prepping for NaNoWriMo. It was kind of interesting because I remember we tried to go to one of the meetups one year.
Yes.
Yeah.
I dragged you to one of the meetups.
Yeah, and it was, to me, it felt kind of awkward because I felt like we could have just went to Starbucks if we wanted to be around people while we're writing, but I think people needed affirmation.
Yeah, I found it kind of strange myself. I was expecting, I don't know what I was expecting. I realize how stupid it was now, but I was expecting, I guess, a support group with chatting or just, you can do it.
Yeah.
But we literally walked in and it was this giant table
Filled with writers,
just
just.
back to back with each other,
Yeah.
saying nothing.
Yeah. Yeah. It was very awkward. I mean, I guess it's just like a way for people to kind of feel like they're studying together for the same exam. That's what it felt like. But either way, I feel like the alternatives for NaNoWriMo are better presented in this article.
Okay.
So there's about 10 of these. Brace yourself.
Okay, let me get my cup of tea and we'll dive right in.
Yes. So first one is play what if.
Okay.
I know that there's a lot of conventionality with the idea that you're just writing fiction most of the time when you're writing a novel, but they go right ahead and express that there are ways to, I guess, exercise your ideas and kind of get your head out of the box. Like one of the questions that they put up here is, what if Canada decided to build a wall too?
Interesting.
It's a yeah, I know. I'm pretty sure we've seen a
Okay.
video about
Let's not even
that.
get into that because it is political season.
Sadly, this whole article has a bunch of political
Oh, joy.
issues in it already.
So it is current.
It's
Great.
quite current. It's very current.
So you're asking me if I agree in playing the what if?
Yes. Do you play with what if, and does it help?
It depends on where you play with it, because I think one of the great things with NaNoWriMo is you're kind of pinned against a corner when it comes down to it to write. Whatever comes out of it, you have to write.
Right.
So when you get to that, I guess that point of desperation, I guess, I don't know what to call it, but when you get to that point where you feel the pressure, you sort of open that like door of breaking the
The
writer's
mold.
block.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, you sort of, there sort of comes a point in NaNoWriMo where you're just like, that's an interesting idea. Instead of me doubting myself, I'm just gonna go with it.
Right.
But as for just a general plot, like this guy is, I guess, I'm assuming that's what he's saying. I'm completely against it.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah, so I don't know what else to say. I guess yes and no.
Yes and no.
It
Okay.
depends on where it is.
Right.
But you know me, I'm like a hardcore planner,
Yes, you do.
as I've
You do plan a
explained.
lot. All right. Identify the storyline.
Okay, that's me in a nutshell.
Yeah. Let's see. He goes right ahead and tries to talk about like how it might be part of your quest, it might not be part of your quest, but it all comes down to go for the quantity over the quality. I understand that as a writer, you have to actually fill the pages. Is that hard to actually do as a novelist?
Okay, so when you're first starting out, and I'm sure anyone that's tried to write a novel has gone through this, I mean, anyone, you'll notice that you write this first chapter and you think you've written really well. And then you find out it's like, if you're lucky, 5 pages. Usually the average is 3 pages. It
Okay.
feels like a Dan Brown novel.
Okay.
I just bashed down Dan Brown. I'm sorry. It's really late,
Like,
but
instead of like a
have you
nine.
ever seen his chapters? Some of them are like half page chapters.
Yeah, also some of them are like 11 typeset fonts. And I'm
Yeah.
just, you know, I'm
Basically,
abashed.
you end up looking like some of the shortest pieces of a Dan Brown novel. And you get really confused, like, okay, now what? And you're like, how do people write these 100 page novels? Then you start to allow yourself to relish in the details. And then there's going to come a point where you overwork the details. And then you're sitting there going, wait, where's the plot? And
Right.
then you end up cutting it. And then you kind of find your balance as a writer.
Okay.
And the only reason why I'm speaking on behalf of most writers out there is because in high school I actually had a writing group and I swear by it. I swear by it. I have seen so many people go through this phase. I think it's just something you have to go through, and I think that's why National Novel Writing Month just sort of makes you break it sooner, because you get a whole month of that
Okay.
instead of like a whole year or a whole 2 years.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I guess this is the, next reasonable question.
Okay.
Flesh out your main characters.
Ugh. I love doing this.
Is it easy?
It's never ending.
Okay.
That's the way I see it. I think fleshing out characters and just characters in general and character development never really stops. In fact, I feel like when we were younger, there wasn't a heck of a lot of it. But nowadays, like the world that is fan fiction and the world of fandom is so crazy.
Right.
Like, what's one that's super popular? Harry Potter or Avatar. You know, there's just meme upon meme upon theory upon fan group upon, you know, like people could just like voice their opinions and character development just seems to grow. To me, that's a sign of an excellent writer, because if there's a fandom where people are constantly guessing or constantly like trying to add to the character, and just because that character is almost living and breathing, I feel like you've done an excellent job. And some of my favorite characters, especially, I find myself constantly trying to just pick scenarios with them. I mean, there are characters that I've worked on for years, like almost a decade at this point. Actually, I think it would be a decade starting now. And I kind of know what they would eat. I kind of know how their sleeping habits are. It's kind of insane. But to me, that's, I guess, the sign of some really awesome character development.
Okay. In their development, he also suggests create a supporting cast. How do you feel about that? I mean, like, I get it. We've done script writing before, and a supporting cast really helps in giving the story, I guess, a better understanding, I guess, background-wise. But as a novelist, how do you actually play with that between 50,000 words?
So I think that especially over the years, I've learned that you think that your main characters and what they do are like the pivot points of the story, but I think it's really the reactions of these supporting cast that create that depth in your
Okay.
character development. Or how many times could you take a shot on how many times we've said development? But I just feel like It's the supporting cast that almost seems to build the culture around it.
Okay.
Because they sort of act as this, not necessarily a fly on the wall, but for a lack of a better term, the fly on the wall, they sort of get to see everything.
Yeah.
And they sort of get to react to everything. Okay. I also feel like you as a writer puts things in these characters that you kind of want the readers to experience.
Right.
Like, if they don't understand everything, they kind of want you to read it with a pair of eyes that you don't quite understand everything in the plot.
Okay.
Do you see where I'm...
No, I see where you're coming from. Yeah, yeah. I mean, okay, going back to the whole script writing thing,
mm-hmm.
like in theater, like, you actually have two characters always talking to each other, and that usually is, like, something what we want the audience to feel. Like, we're telling them mm-hmm. how to feel. You know, it's like that applause sign that kind of comes up when you want, you know, when you're in, like, the audience of a, you know, sitcom.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an oration over what is considered normal in that world.
Right.
So, I guess the same thing happens with... writing here, because I'm just trying to wrap my head around it, because, like, in script writing, it's easy. It's just reaction, reaction, reaction within, like, you know, even two pages.
Well, it's funny you mention that, because I always remember this. I was in a screenplay class with you.
Yeah.
And the teacher was so upset that we were playwrights. I don't know what it was. I guess apparently screenwriters and playwrights don't get along.
No.
And I didn't really know.
Okay.
But anyways, he was discussing how it's easier to write a film because you can come at it in all directions. And you can change up the time frames. You can change up your character perspectives and everything. Whereas in a play, you have dialogue and you have
the actors
and just the gestures that tell you what is going on and sets the tone. And to me, I don't know, like, as a novelist, seeing it, like, full circle, I kind of feel like playwriting reminds me more of novel writing, because you're sort of immersing your reader. Whereas, yeah. like, in a movie, you want to immerse them in the world, but you're more into, like, the aesthetic emotion. Like, you want to capture more of an emotion as opposed to a story plot.
Yeah.
I don't know. Come at me. but that's kind of how I see it, especially, I mean, we joke about it all the time, but, like, Michael Bay... oh my god, I'm trying to think of that martial artist, cinematographer, John Woo?
John Woo, yeah.
Yeah, but you feel, like, an emotion when you watch their stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And I think they're more into the aesthetic of emotion as opposed to plot, and the plot is sort of, like, second nature. And I noticed that with, like, action films is... You don't really, I mean, I know it sounds terrible, like, oh, there's no plot in action films. It's like, not necessarily. I feel like they're more caught up on the aesthetic and you feeling like a hero in this, like, impulsive kind of pressured situation.
Yeah.
And then the plot follows afterwards. But I don't feel like that's necessarily the same with playwriting and novel writing.
Yeah. I mean, playwriting, you actually... have to have trust with your actors. You know, you trust that the actors will actually convey the emotion well enough to pull the audience in to react.
See, it's funny because, again, we're translating this into novel writing. I feel like as a good writer, you're almost a steward to these characters.
Yeah.
And so when you get a new character, you need to treat them well. And what I mean by that is, of course, there's going to be a few characters that just kind of get the butt end of everything.
Yeah.
But you need to do it in a way that it's good for them because they're creating some sort of reaction or, I guess
Building
domino
momentum.
effect. There
Yeah,
you
there's
go.
no momentum here.
And I feel like, in a way, as a novelist, you're really responsible for that. So if you introduce a character, there is no such thing as just the passing character.
Right.
I've seen so many plots fail where people have just taken like 10 different characters and decided to throw them in one plot and have them run around like the Canterbury Tales. And I mean, there's nothing wrong with plots like that, but if you're new, please, I mean, seriously, to you guys, if you're new, please don't try that. You'll probably be working on that novel for a while because it's really hard. You have to develop these characters.
Yeah. Which is funny because I remember you had this one novel of Oh My Goddess, the anime and the manga. You had an actual written
Yes, I did.
novel of that story, and it was so confusing reading it because they're all like screaming and like running everywhere, and like three things are happening all at once, and it was kind of hard to actually like stop the ADHD.
Well, to be fair, from what I was, I mean, it's been so long since I've read that novel, but I believe that the original creator wrote it as like a companion
To
to the one to the series.
okay.
But what was really interesting is he allowed, I think it was one of the voice actresses to translate it.
Oh, okay.
So she did the American translation of it. So I wonder
Well,
if that had a lot to do with it.
that author practically rewrote Oh My Goddess about at least three times.
Yeah, and
There's
that's why
like.
I love, that's one of my favorite anime series, by the way. I just love seeing all the different perspectives.
Yeah. All right.
But we went on that tangent,
I
so.
know, but I just wanted to actually bring that up because it kind of bring it all kind of ties in with the next suggestion this guy has.
Okay.
Observe the group as a whole. Yeah?
Yeah, but you can't get to that level unless you've been a good steward to them as a whole.
Right.
So
Yeah, he
I
said.
don't think that's really great advice for NaNoWriMo, to be honest, because I feel
Okay.
like that happens mainly in the editing process, to be honest with you.
Well, he says that it happens between drafts. You know, the more drafts you write, the more, subplots you
Yeah, I'm
actually come up
actually on
with.
my third draft for Redemption. I think I'm on my fourth draft for Recollection. And I'm finally on my first draft of Nocturnal Notes.
Do we need to get you an editor? But nevertheless, I'm happy that you actually can give this kind of advice to like new writers that are actually starting up NaNoWriMo, because a lot of people don't get enough experience writing, and I feel almost as though like when people, dive into NaNoWriMo, they don't know what to expect. And they wonder why they fail.
Yeah. If Candace, if you're listening, I remember just her dealing with how cocky I was when I first started National Novel Writing Month.
I think it was your third attempt.
It was my third attempt, and I thought I was amazing. And you get kind of like cocky, but you never really. I didn't finish. I thought I could. But then when I started looking at it in a tactical way, and sort of like it's an exercise to get it done, period, it's not supposed to be glamorous and happy. It is a marathon. It is gritty. It is, I think that's if I could say anything, get ready to be feel to feel lonely. Get ready to feel I guess, questioning what the hell you're doing half the time. Get ready to just, I guess there are just gonna be bouts of sadness because you are literally a machine at one point.
Right.
And you're trying to portray this beautiful novel, but there's just a point where you're balancing you as a machine, as a thing creating something, as
Right.
opposed to an artist, and that's what you're gonna have to deal with. You're literally gonna face your biggest like weaknesses as a writer on NaNoWriMo.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's a really like I remember every time I think of NaNoWriMo, I think of being very cold because it's November and you have to sit still. And anyone that knows me, I don't like to sit still, ironically. So you just feel really cold and you feel very alone because there will come points where you will just have to tell people, as much as this is the season to get along and see each other or talk to each other. I mean, COVID might help you as an excuse, but
Thanksgiving doesn't.
yeah, you're going to have to deal with excusing yourself
Right.
from these social responsibilities to get this done.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oof, all right.
Yeah, and like you mentioned, I mean, again, I have a bone to pick with National Novel Writing Month being in November because there's a lot of things that happen in November. And also, plan for your novel ahead of time. Like they said, declare your novel probably a week or two ahead. Because your Halloween, you're going to be plagued with
Jeez.
this thought. And I can't begin to tell you, like, once midnight hits at your Halloween night, you're gonna want to hit that keyboard as hard as you can. So,
All right.
it's a very lonely month. But if you're really serious and you're really looking to build up as a novelist, you will be paid forward bazillions of times for
Okay.
doing this for yourself. It's really an act of getting in there.
Okay. I see what you did there, though. Using a fictitious, number for fiction writing.
Oh.
Oh.
Insert Eugene's dad jokes.
Oh, no. We don't have kids.
We have two dogs, and so Eugene has withdrawals, which he
Right.
cracks really terrible dad jokes.
Well, they give me confusing looks, but it's good enough. So, the next suggestion he has is focus on the individuals who interest you. So, I guess
Oh,
after
okay.
building a group, who interests you?
I usually have the hardest time writing the villains, so I give them extra care.
It's really awkward because that's supposed to be basically the secondary character of the entire novel. Protagonist versus
Well, I
antagonist.
feel like protagonists are predictable, but a really good villain is one, or antagonist is one that you want to root for.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Any villains you've actually wanted to root for when reading?
In my writing or in.
In other books, because that's the ordeal. You just said that you'd want to root for them.
Lady Poe, or what is it called? Mrs. Poe is pretty phenomenal.
Yeah.
Yeah. Read it.
Okay.
The antagonist is actually Poe's wife.
Oh, okay. That's interesting. Like Edgar Allan Poe?
Edgar Allan Poe's wife.
Okay.
Because it's actually written through the eyes of his mistress.
Ah.
It's a historical fiction. But it's actually written through the eyes of his mistress and how Edgar Allan Poe is actually in this really weird relationship with his cousin
Right.
and how he married his cousin. I can't remember her name off the top of my head.
That's okay. Mrs. Poe.
Mrs. Poe. So she's painted as a villain the whole time, but there's like a total plot twist ending. And it's not the greatest written book, in my opinion, but I keep it because just the timing in the book is so excellently done that it really makes you, in the end, like, rooting for the antagonist.
Yes.
Yeah,
the antagonist, definitely.
What else? Who's another one?
Okay, silly question.
Mm-hmm.
Because I feel like in Bridget Jones, I feel like the actual antagonist is Bridget herself.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, absolutely. It's funny, but she is much more the antagonist than the protagonist.
But that's why she's so infamous as a book, because you're reading it in a diary form, and it's what women go through in terms of rhetoric. Like, you are your worst enemy. We're kind of taught to be super judgmental of ourselves and put ourselves on, like, levels of unattainability.
Right.
That Bridget reflects that unattainability. Okay. And the great thing about the trilogy is it starts with her just kind of feeling like a stale chicken because she needs to find a husband or an actual serious boyfriend. And at the same time, succeed in her career. I mean, what woman can't relate to that, right?
Exactly.
And then the second book is more about, can she maintain it? Can she actually pull this off, or is she lying to herself? And the final book, which, in my opinion, Helen Fielding, you did a really good job on, is about getting old. And asking yourself if you're irrelevant anymore. And imagine if you lose all the things you thought you had, only to feel like you were pretending. And then setting a new standard for yourself as a mother, or let's say a woman in her 40s.
Right.
So it's a pretty interesting series.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, because I hate to say, I don't have too many villains I want to root for. I mean, even in Lord of the Rings, like, Sauron is a pretty weak villain, even though he's, like, the giant eye, you know, like, staring towards everybody. But Saruman was awesome. He was great. And I guess I could have rooted for the guy, but even then, I just felt like the villains were strong, but I felt like I couldn't like hating them enough.
Hmm.
You know? Like, at least with comic books, you love hating some of these villains. Like, especially with the Joker, like, being such a big, popular, like, mainstream character out there.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting. I never really thought of it like that.
Well, I know an antagonist that kind of warms everybody's heart, if you've read it, is Hook from Peter Pan.
Oh, you can't. Yeah, that's but hard to,
again, back oh to that God. Whole reflection. Yes. I think Hook is a reflection of growing old and asking yourself if you did it right, because he's constantly in the face of this overconfident boy.
Yeah.
Who gets a second chance every single time.
Yeah.
And Jazz doesn't get a second chance.
Yeah.
He has to live with his consequences.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I'm there for Hook. I'm definitely there for
Hook. I'm Team Hook. Yeah. Absolutely. And by the way, I don't know if it's just me, but did anyone else think that Mr. Smee was a psychotic one in the book?
Oh my goodness.
Because yes. I swear, He's horrific. And if ever I were to write a sequel fan fiction of Peter Pan, he would be the villain because he was messed up in the head. And I'm not gonna say anything else other than Johnny Corkscrew. If you've read it, you know what I'm talking about. Messed up. It's the thing of nightmares.
Oh, I think I remember a villain I actually do like. The Headless Horseman. Like, I totally rooted for him after reading, like, Sleepy Hollow.
It's so funny because isn't the Lindsay and Jonas were doing a thing on the bicentennial?
Yes!
You know what's funny is I was doing my teaching today and I actually had to teach about the Dutch in New York and how
Yes!
the English took over and how Sleepy Hollow was written as actually a reflection of that.
Right.
Because it is a metaphor of actual history that people don't realize.
Ooh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, because, like, Ichabod Crane is such a schmuck. Like, the guy lives off of everybody's charity and he, like, milks it. You know? And he was just a horrible person. Like, he would be, like, the nightmare of, like, tutors and teachers out there.
Well, since we're getting political, that's how they felt about Englishmen.
And how the henshin, was it called?
The Hessian.
Hessian, yes, the Hessian actually attacks.
Yeah, so the history is the Dutch actually settled in New York, and that's why it's called New Amsterdam. Was
Right.
called New Amsterdam. I guess we have a detour for a little
Wait, yeah,
lesson.
let's do that. Come on.
But basically, what ended up happening is the king had a lot of gambling debt, and so he just kind of gave land on of America, and these people would get it. And I forgot who it was. I believe it was the Duke of York that went in, and the English took over. I think it was 1664, I want to say. But the Dutch were there for a good, I want to say a good 40, 50 years before they came in. And so, or was it the French? I don't know. Either way, there was a lot of stuff going on. They split it in half. And at first the Dutch thought, oh no, they're going to like take over our land and such, but they were able to work it out to where they kept their rights, their land rights. So it was kind of a peaceful takeover. And I get it kind of muddled because I know there was like a lot going on in Vermont and Delaware at the same time as well. I'm talking about the middle colonies and how they were founded. There's a lot going on. But I know that there was like a mix between there was a war with the Native Americans. Some of them got peace. They actually created like reservations for them. They were like signs of the first protected lands, so on and so forth. But yeah, there was a lot of controversy over the English and were they going to kick out the Dutch? Were they going to disobey like disrespect their culture? But the Duke of York actually preserved it and gave them rights. Yeah, so it was really fascinating. Yeah.
Well, getting back into novel writing,
Okay.
the next suggestion this guy has is find your key scenes.
Yes, absolutely. 100%.
Okay.
Yeah. I think that what I look for in a scene is tension between characters.
Okay.
I think that's something I really look for, or what transforms a character.
All right.
Yeah.
Is it like constructing a screenplay for just B movies? You just go right ahead and have the protagonist feel like he could do something, and then he goes through the challenge and then feels like he could triumph, but then he fails and then gets back up again to actually win.
That is a mouthful. For me, it's weird because, like, for example, this scene I'm working on, my character is supposed to, my protagonist is about to turn into the antagonist, whether she agrees to or not. And that's because there's actually a curse on her. And she doesn't know it, but she ends up basically becoming a necromancer, and she's like called to this grave. And it's this con it's the whole chapter is just this monologue with herself questioning what she's done through her past. And she's being called to this person she's never met but is of great importance. And she ends up trying to talk to that soul, which in turn she ends up raising them from the dead in this like horrible zombie sort of thing. And I have been struggling with that scene forever. But the thing that's hard for me to write in it is you know things are about to go down. And how do you do it delicately enough to where people follow or people understand the significance of it, but at the same time, how do you do it without it sounding cheesy? Like, and then she was bad, you know? You don't want that. You have to tread delicately on those scenes, but it's worth it.
Nice. I mean, when you actually write some of these character developments, are you just hoping that you could find inspiration for those scenes? Like, do you look at other people, or do you like read other books to actually kind of like gather some form of like reconciliation as to what you want to convey?
Well, I really think about foreshadowing for one. And I really think about how do I treat this in a way to know that the mood or the pivot of my story is here. So it's like the cornerstone domino. You want it to fall, but how do you want it to fall so that it handles the rest of the plot?
For first-time writers, do you think that's feasible for them, or do you think that's usually like something a little more advanced that they don't realize could actually,
Okay,
not be
so
done the first time?
speaking one-on-one with them, these are the hardest scenes you're going to write. Definitely take your time with these. If you don't have the time to take your time on these, keep a notebook in hand and write as much notes about it as it unfolds. Just keep a memo. It'll start to process through the day or the week. Or whatever time you have. But if you get stuck on these, it's okay. Normally, you will get stuck on these. I find that when I write these, there's hardly any editing. When you go into the second stage of editing, you hardly edit these scenes because
Like the
you've,
second draft and third
yeah, you
draft.
hardly do because you take so much time focusing on these scenes and making sure that they work for the rest of the scenes. So, if you can't do it, it's fine. It's okay to jump around in your writing, but just make sure that your thoughts on it are very well documented and you can return to them.
So basically, these are the scenes where you could feel like Tolkien. Just write unnecessarily beautiful words and.
Or don't write at all. Just write a little note to yourself. This is where this happens, and carry on.
Very well. The next suggestion this guy has is write the jacket blurb.
You know, it's interesting because they actually do have a little section for that in the NaNoWriMo website.
Yeah, 'cause like I don't know. Personally, I always have fun filling that out, but obviously, I can never actually write a novel.
But to me, it's kind of the equivalent of like designing your pitch.
That's interesting.
Because that's what you're doing on a dust jacket is you're pitching your story. Unless you're one of those sick people that fall for covers. I'm well, looking at you.
Yeah. So it's like a PR when you actually release, you know, when your play is about to come up in like the next month or so.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, those are fun. Those are fun. Well, the next one he says is write a 2-page outline. I feel like this should have been the first thing you were supposed to do. Like, really, man. Like,
yeah, absolutely. I mean, I remember writing off the seat of my pants versus writing through a plot versus writing through a mind map.
Yeah. Yeah.
If I had to rate them, it would be 3 off the seat of your pants, 2 a mind map, 1 a plot.
Yeah.
Okay. Or a pre-written out outline.
Yeah.
Mind maps, I feel, are not committed enough. Because you can move everything around.
Yeah.
I don't know. They work, but they don't at the same time.
I mean, I remember us actually collaborating on a play, and we would, like, get ideas literally at restaurants. I don't know if it was the caffeine talking, but we would pick up napkins, lots of napkins, and just start writing stuff.
I feel like you can do that if you have a plot.
Right.
Or if you have an outline. Because it kind of takes that pressure off of you of it becoming something, I guess, rambly.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The next thing he suggests is pack for your expedition.
Yep.
Yeah? Do you know what that means?
Go ahead and my assumption is just get, like, nesting, like I was talking about before. You need to get yourself situated. You need to make sure that you have the equipment you need. You need to understand the habits that you have.
Right.
You need to block out amount of time, a piece of time, for what you're about to do. You need to understand your limits.
Okay.
Yeah, definitely.
All right.
Did I catch that? Is that kind of what he was talking about?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he added that you should find some writing buddies, which I actually disagree with.
Unless you've known the people long enough, I think that's a terrible idea. Because I've tried writing, like, starting writing groups and making writing groups, and I think the saddest reality you realize as a writer is there are people that are really, really serious about it, and then there are people that aren't, and they're just hobbyists, and once it hits the fan, they're not going to push through with it.
Okay.
And with novel writing, you always hit the fan.
Yeah.
There's just a point.
So.
But, yeah, absolutely. I think my biggest tip for new writers is make note of these habits that work for you.
Mm. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, because not every writer is the same.
Right.
So, how, like, do you actually cater that?
Yeah, like, what makes you tick, or if you've had a breakthrough, what did you do? How could you repeat that?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, from what it looks like, there are only just 8 of these. Oh. So I guess I have 2 questions.
Oh, shoot.
1, NaNoWriMo has a gauge in your progress.
Mm-hmm.
Does that irritate you?
No.
Really?
It's really important because it tells you the statistics of if you're writing at this pace, what day you're going to finish. What your average is.
But doesn't that give you a false hope? Like, doesn't that make you, like, relax and just say, I could leave that for later?
Nope.
What do you mean, no?
It does the opposite.
Okay.
So, here, I'm gonna log on to the website right now. Okay. So, I Google searched, NaNoWriMo daily word count, and they recommend 1,667 words per day.
Right.
So if you divide that by 30, you get your 50,000 word novel.
Yes.
So the reason why they put that out there is because your goal is to write a minimum of that per day.
Okay.
And yes, it puts pressure on you. It irritates you, but it makes sure that you stay on track. And I've made the mistake many a time before I figured it out the hard way that you try to stick to that consistency as much as possible. Unless you're those insane people that write 5,000 words a day.
Right.
Which, from advice from an experienced writer, I can tell you now you will hurt your brain. So please don't wait, because if you do the math, like let's say a 5,000 word count, right?
Yes.
That's like what, 3 or 4 of those days? So if you miss 3 or 4 days of writing, you're going to have to make up
For all
the
that.
5,000 word count piece.
Right.
And you will burn yourself out.
Okay.
So that's really there to tell you, yeah, you can move forward, but you might burn yourself out.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can fall behind, but you're going to have to catch up later. And that's kind of why the gauge is there.
Okay. Well, due to that, because I do worry, how does anyone warm up for it? I mean, you're gonna tell me that J.K. Rowling, who wrote her first draft of Harry Potter in the first chapter, finishing the whole story in that one chapter, is not gonna happen to all these other writers. I mean, if she, had to write like 10 to like 1,000 drafts just to finally get to this version of, of the book that we actually all love and read, do people actually have to expect the same?
I would say yes.
Okay.
Since Gaiman is such a hot ticket here,
Oh, yes, thank you.
we were talking about his lectures and when we attended, and one thing that really stuck with me as a writer was he said someone had asked him, how long does it take to write a novel?
Oh, I love that one. That was great.
And he said it could take between, what was it, 2 months to 30 years. And his reasoning was The Ocean at the End of the Lane. He was a more experienced writer when he wrote that. And he was lovesick with his current wife. And he missed her, so he wrote that story technically for her. And it just kind of came out of him, but he had that skill level to keep it on track and to make it a novel.
It was kind
So,
of an accident.
yeah, it was a sheer accident. It was actually a love story for her.
Yeah.
But then he had the idea of the graveyard book ever since he was a young writer, but he admitted that he just didn't have the skill level for it.
Right.
So he constantly pecked at it, until finally he was able to put it down on paper and finish it.
Yeah, it took him 22 years.
22, was it? I thought it was
22.
30, but
It was
that's good.
close. Yeah. There you go.
And I can definitely say a lot of my writing is the same. I think that's why there's so many revisions and so many drafts.
Okay.
But I will say this, as a playwriter, you're gonna write one really bad one.
Of
And
course.
don't be afraid of that really bad one. If this is your really bad one, that's okay. You're going to learn all the things wrong with it, and you can always rewrite it, and you're going to be so glad that you did.
I think we mentioned it once that we produced our first play.
Yeah, that was terrible.
Yeah, that was like our Mary Sue.
Oh, it was horrible.
Yeah, it was really bad. And there even came a point where even the actors were begging, like, can we please rewrite some of this? And we would be so emotionally attached to the piece to the point where we told them if there's grammatical issues, just say it. They did. Oh my goodness, they did. Thank God that they were such good sports. But yeah. All right. Well, with that, I guess what kind of advice would you like to give to new NaNoWriMo writers? Because it's a marathon.
If you have the funds, or if you're already on it, make sure to sign up to 750 words. Because I would not have been able to do it if it weren't for that. I mean, that's just my pro tip, I guess.
Okay.
I mean, I was kind of grandfathered into it, but I believe the first month is free and it's $5 after that a month. It's like something.
Words.
Yeah, it's something cheap and ridiculous. And it goes to a great family. It's developed actually by a husband and wife team.
Oh, nice.
So it helps them raise their child.
Okay.
I believe they have a 2-year-old. It's a really great tool. Right. If you do not have that, make sure, I think my friend sets timers like every hour.
Hmm.
Her computer will be better just to make her conscious that she's written for an hour.
Hmm.
Yeah. What's another thing? The 5-minute rule.
What's the 5-minute rule?
You have to, if you really don't feel like writing, you have to write just anything for 5 minutes. It'll break the writer's block.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that sounds like fun.
But get ready to be lonely, I guess, is the best thing I can say.
I guess I have to, like, ask this redundant question. I mean, like, I'm a publisher here. I have yet to actually brought in a novelist under my, I guess, under my brand.
Okay.
How do you decide to be a writer in a world filled with self-publishers?
Ooh, that's a really good one. Because I got really discouraged for a long time.
Okay.
So, my story is, what motivated me to write was, okay, like anyone, I started as a fan fiction writer. Didn't think anything of it. Went into playwriting. Told stories that I wanted to tell more of.
Okay.
And I couldn't get it out of my head. And I started writing as gifts. I mean, I originally started writing Fate Pendulum, the story, because it was kind of like a gift to you.
Right.
And to my friends. You know, just giving them the gift of storytelling. I know that sounds so cheesy, but it meant a lot to me. Then I got back into reading again. I loved just the different ways things were told. And I realized halfway through, because I was super discouraged, like, I'm never going to write like that.
Yeah.
I'm never going to want to write like, or can write like that. That's like, what's trendy is not what I like writing.
Yeah.
So years down the line happened, and I realized that these stories that came up that I thought were similar to the stories I told, they all happened, but they didn't tell it in the way that I would have told it. And I realized that I had a totally different voice than this person.
Okay.
And that's sort of when I decided I wanted to write again.
Interesting.
Because I knew that my form of storytelling isn't anything necessarily new, but I definitely had a voice that was not heard yet.
Right.
Or if there was a voice similar to what I had, at least I would be in good company.
Interesting. Interesting.
So that's what encouraged me to go into it.
I've read a lot of people's works where they imitate their favorite writer.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting because, like, you found your voice.
Right.
And I don't know if a lot of writers actually find their voice all too frequently. I mean, I feel like sometimes a lot of writers would be great ghostwriters, but they prefer being novelists. And in that, would you encourage people to imitate other people's writings to at least figure out their voice.
I believe it's really good to read as much and as big of a variety as possible
Right.
because I guess the best way to explain it is the way Daniel Handler says it to the kids. If tell your kids not to be writers because writing is such a boring job because you do research.
Yeah.
You're stuck in a library all day. You're constantly, studying.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's so accurate. But learn to love reading before you become a writer because you need to learn to study and understand things and understand the mechanics. I mean, if you find any person that's a great filmmaker,
Right.
they're usually cinephiles. And they can go for hours and hours over the techniques and the methods that were used for XYZ of film. And I think that it's kind of sad that novelists sort of get this like magician rap where people think we just sit alone. And these beautiful ideas come into our heads like sirens singing in our ears, and we just magically throw them on paper and breathe life into them. And it's like this weird mysticism behind it. But it's, I feel like the more I write, the less I feel that mysticism.
It's interesting because I'm just gonna veer away from this topic for a little bit. We were watching Outlander last night, and I felt like the writer did not understand what he or she was writing about. Because we saw Scotsmen worrying about rings and using the vows, like modern vows,
Which were made during
like
the Civil War,
1800s. Yeah, yeah,
they were specifically created because people would get married on the slave trade.
yeah.
Or the Underground Railroad.
Exactly.
And that's why our wedding vows are the way they are.
Yeah, and I'm not even too sure if a wedding dress was actually a thing back in those
I
days either.
don't know if the white dress was a thing. I think actually Queen Victoria was the one that started the white dress
Yeah, she
trend.
did. So, like, I'm pretty sure, like, even in American weddings, they didn't really wear white unless they were rich. You know?
Or it was like an undergarment.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, but anyways.
But I guess that's where I'm just kind of like teasing here, because you're telling people that to be a writer, you have to be ready to research. And, you know, angels sing in your ears, supposedly. And that's kind of what I saw last night. I'm like, I'm pretty sure angels were singing
I
in
mean,
this
okay,
author's like
so
ear.
I'm not gonna sit
So
here and be a big plebe about it, but the reality is writer's block for me happens a lot on just not understanding how to execute things.
right.
And I feel like that's something you can only develop over time and over like lessons learned.
Yeah.
And part of that is just seeing the way that others have done it. So that's why you have to read.
Okay.
But falling in love with reading, that I guess that whimsy that you hear, the siren song,
Yeah.
mysticism of it, I think it comes from the fact that a well-written novel will have that effect. You'll
Yeah.
believe that it was God breathed and this beautiful masterpiece from the get-go. But that's the magic behind it, is it looks like you're not trying.
Right. Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, isn't that basically an entertainer's job?
Yeah.
Literally, to not make it look hard.
Yeah.
Okay.
So once you get to that point, you'll know.
Okay.
I mean, I'm not gonna sit here and toot my own horn, but I've definitely worked years and years to get to that point.
Okay. Well, for those that actually succeed in like their first round, you are a miracle
Yeah.
at this point.
If
But
you guys do it this year, hit me up. I will totally send you guys tea. It's
no. That's so cute.
just,
That's so
oh
sweet.
my goodness. If you can do it your first time, I mean, just wow. Congratulations. We'll
Yeah.
throw a total tea party for you.
Would you encourage plagiarism?
No.
I mean, you could edit it.
Oh my goodness.
I'm sorry. It's a bad. I'm bad. I'm bad. I'm
You
sorry.
really are.
Oh. But yeah, I don't know how you deal with the torture, but
Oh
I commend
yeah.
you.
I guess that's a good question to ask you as the closing cap here. How does it
Yes.
look when I'm writing?
Oh my God! I'm so worried for your health. You get these bags under your eyes, and then you like age 10 times. And I'm like, are you sure you didn't want to get into law because you are aging so quickly? But enough about me. I guess at this point, would you actually just have everybody enjoy your tea and learn how to cozy up? I mean,
Yeah, that's gonna be your greatest ally, to
yeah.
be honest, is just, oh my God, this is cheesy, but just if you can find stillness, like a piece of stillness in yourself, so you're ready for it. And part of that is just getting yourself settled to do it.
Okay. That's beautiful. Well, to that, dear writers,
Break a leg.
break a leg.
We're here for you.
So,
Cheers.
cheers.